Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, April 12, 2023. President Joe Biden celebrates the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, calling on both sides in that historic peace deal to settle a current dispute over trade and Great Britain's exit from the European Union, so-called Brexit. Coming up, we hear from President Biden and talk about his trip to Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, the country of his ancestors, with USA Today White House correspondent Joey Garrison, who's traveling with the president. Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, announcing he's forming a 2024 presidential exploratory committee, a step toward a possible run for the White House. Senator Scott saying he will never back down in defense of our conservative values that make America exceptional. Democratic Tennessee state lawmaker Justin Pearson, who was expelled by Republican state representatives after he led an anti-gun violence protest in the House chamber in Tennessee, was reappointed today to his seat by county commissioners. Wall Street Journal news editor and other journalists gathering at Columbia University School of Journalism in New York City talking about efforts to free Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who is in a Russian prison charged with espionage. Both the U.S. government and the Journal say those charges are false. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky calling on world leaders to respond after a video surfaced apparently showing Ukrainian soldier being beheaded by a Russian soldier. President Zelensky saying everyone must react, every leader, do not wait for this to be forgotten. Ukraine's Secret Service says it's investigating it as a war crime. And the U.S. becomes the first major commercial fishing nation to ratify a World Trade Organization agreement to cut subsidies that leads to overfishing. And we start with President Biden in Northern Ireland. This from CNN. When President Joe Biden spoke here Wednesday to mark the quarter century of the Good Friday Agreement, it wasn't from the seat of the Northern Ireland Assembly, currently suspended over a Brexit trade dispute, but from a new university campus downtown. The choice of venue for President Biden's sole public event in Belfast was a symbolic one. While decades of violence between nationalists and unionists have been mostly left to another era, the peace is fragile and the politics are broken, making President Biden's speech to students as much about the future of this region as its bloody past. Here's the president at Ulster University.
Now, I know the UK's departure from the European Union created complex challenges here in Northern Ireland. And I encourage the leaders of the UK and the EU to address the issues in a way that serve Northern Ireland's best interests. I deeply appreciate the personal leadership of Prime Minister Sunak and European Commissioner von der Leyen to reach an agreement. The Windsor Framework addresses the practical realities of Brexit and the essentials, and it's an essential step to ensuring hard-earned peace and progress of the Good Friday Agreements, that they're preserved and strengthened. You know, the negotiators listened to business leaders across the UK and Ireland who shared what they needed to succeed. And I believe the stability and predictability offered by this framework will encourage greater investment in Northern Ireland, significant investment in Northern Ireland. I come from a little state where, the state of Delaware and back home, has more corporations that are registered in that state than every other state in the union combined. So I know a little bit about corporate attitudes. All the immense progress we see around us was built through conversation and compromise, discussion and debate, voting and inclusion. It's an incredible attestation to the power of democracy to deliver needs for all the people. And now I know better than most how hard democracy can be at times. We in the United States have firsthand experience how fragile even long-standing democratic institutions can be. You saw what happened on January the 6th in my country. We learn anew with every generation that democracy needs champions. When I went to college, I was a political science major and history major. We were taught every generation has to fight to preserve democracies. I didn't believe it at the time. I just thought it was automatic. We had this great democracy. What would we need to do? As a friend, I hope it's not too presumptuous for me to say that I believe democratic institutions established through the Good Friday Agreement remain critical to the future of Northern Ireland. It's a decision for you to make, not for me to make. But it seems to me they're related. An effective, devolved government that reflects the people of Northern Ireland and is accountable to them. A government that works to find ways through hard problems together is going to draw even greater opportunity in this region. So I hope the Assembly and the Executive will soon be restored. That's a judgment for you to make, not me, but I hope it happens. Along with the institutions that facilitate North-South and East-West relations, all of which are vital pieces of the Good Friday Agreement.
President Biden at Ulster University, Belfast, Northern Ireland. USA Today White House correspondent Joey Garrison is traveling with the president and joins us now from Ireland. Thanks so much for being with us. President Biden praised the Good Friday Agreement 25 years ago. It ended fighting in Northern Ireland between those wishing to stay part of the United Kingdom and those who wanted to reunite with Ireland. But today, the president said, I hope the Northern Ireland Assembly will soon be restored. What's going on?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, President Biden's trip to Belfast, I mean, came at a real precarious time, really. I mean, on the one hand, there has been, as you said, 25 years of relative peace and the what's known as the Troubles that we saw with constant guerrilla warfare between competing camps in Northern Ireland has ceased. But there is this political dispute on the ground that has really made the Northern Ireland local government non-existent. The Assembly is not meeting, hasn't met for more than a year over a land dispute, trade dispute following Brexit. And, you know, as a result of that, they were at this time where, yeah, the agreement is kind of at a crossroads right now. And for to be effective going forward, you know, this kind of shared power structure of its government, you need both sides taking part. And the side that left was the Democratic Unionist Party. They were the ones who are sitting out right now and would need to come back to the table in order for that government to move forward.
And President Biden also making a point of talking about the need for more economic investment in Northern Ireland. How much a part of the strategy is that?
Well, that's a huge deal. I mean, in walking around Belfast the last day or so, I mean, you know, there is some areas, you know, that have seen incredible resurgence since it was in the 90s. But you know, they still are left out of some of the larger prosperity of the United Kingdom. And so, you know, Biden made the point that peace and opportunity are tied together. And so that was a big theme. And, you know, they have had, he stressed a lot of the improvements that have been made over the last 25 years. He called it, alive with commerce, art, and inspiration, comparing the picture of Belfast today to the one that was largely barricaded with walls throughout much of it during the 90s. But there's still a long way to go for it to be at the level of other areas in the UK.
President Biden now making his way to the Republic of Ireland. What's on the agenda?
Well, this is the part of the trip that Biden really relishes in the most, and you can tell he's excited about it. I mean, he started off in County Louth, which is has some ancestral connections to President Biden's mother's side. As you, for anyone who covers President Biden or listens to him for just a minute, you hear him bring up his Catholic Irish family history. His ancestors arrived in the mid-19th century as a result of the Great Famine in Ireland. And so today he started off going to a 12th century castle that's in that County Louth, which is tied to his family. He also stopped by a local deli. He said he told people there, you know, this country is so beautiful. I have no idea what the hell my ancestors were thinking leaving here. Of course, well, the answer is that potato famine, which was resulted in so many Irish people coming to America.
We're talking with USA Today White House correspondent Joey Garrison, traveling with the president in Ireland. Returning to his stop in Northern Ireland, you wrote at usatoday.com ahead of the president's speech, local police lost documents that detailed sensitive security information. What was that about?
Yeah, so on, I guess it would have been Tuesday night, a citizen in Belfast located a document that contained names of Belfast police officers and their stationing positions. Belfast was a heavily guarded city for President Biden's event. And, you know, that was a breach of security that this individual, I think, flagged to BBC News. And so that put it on the spotlight. That's how the U.S. government found out about it. You know, the Secret Service, the U.S. law enforcement officials have stressed that the Secret Service was not compromised by the revelation of this document that was found. And, you know, they said that reiterating the fact that it didn't contain any Secret Service information. But this could have been a potentially, dangerous breach considering by the local law enforcement in Northern Ireland. Considering, you know, just the history of violence that has been in Belfast, the terrorism level in Northern Ireland was raised to severe ahead of President Biden's trip. And, you know, there was a attempted assassination of a top police official in Northern Ireland just a month or so ago. So this was, you know, definitely a serious mistake by the Belfast police, but the U.S. government, the Biden administration, has said that the Secret Service still has trust in its partners, and that obviously President Biden had a safe trip in Belfast and is now in Ireland as we speak.
And final question: a lot of presidents have made the trip to Ireland. How has President Biden been received, both in Northern Ireland and in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, he's been received well in both. And, you know, there weren't huge throngs of people in Belfast, but there were, you know, at moments as he was leaving his hotel and gathering for his speech, you know, there were sizable packs of people there. Now, you know, if you get further into the country and in unionists who identify more with the British government and Democratic Unionists, party members, you know, they're more skeptical generally of a United States president who is so outspokenly embracing an Irish identity. But nevertheless, in Belfast, I mean, I do think it was overwhelmingly strong support there. Now, here in Ireland, when he came, you know, you saw people holding signs, you know, welcoming Biden here. And even one person I saw holding they were seen photographed holding Biden's memoir, his biography. And so it's been a warm reception so far. Undoubtedly, tomorrow Biden will be spending Thursday meeting with local Dublin and Ireland officials here. And so I think we can expect more of that sentiment coming Thursday.
Joey Garrison, USA Today White House correspondent, traveling with President Biden in Ireland. His story is at usatoday.com and on Twitter at Joey Garrison. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
And during the president's stop in Dundalk, Ireland, at the Windsor Bar and Restaurant, he spoke to the crowd, introduced by Irish Foreign Minister Michael Martin.
Much has been achieved since 1998, but there remains a farther shore to reach. We must ensure that all communities and all traditions fully enjoy the benefits of peace and have the opportunity to live on a truly reconciled island. And as we take forward that work, Mr. President, we know that we do so with the full support of the United States. The engagement of the United States in the peace process gave us the Good Friday Agreement. And unwavering bipartisan commitment that you, above all, personified over the last 25 years, President, including through the creation and sustainability of the International Fund for Ireland, that support continues to open up horizons for us. As we build on the ambitions of the Good Friday Agreement to sustain a dynamic and prosperous peace, the United States will remain a central and fundamental partner. It is a privilege to welcome you here, Mr. President, to celebrate all that has been achieved and to look forward together to the shining possibilities of our future. Welcome home, Mr. President.
Well, it feels like home. I said last time I was here, in a sense, I know why my ancestors and many of your relatives left during the famine. And you know, when you're here, you wonder why anyone would ever want to leave. I mean it. So it's good to be back. And I want to thank another proud son of Louth, Prime Minister Martin, the guy behind me here. Now, I met him when he was the teacher. And the bad news was we put him up in lovely quarters across from the White House, and he had COVID. So, in fact, I'm here with my sister Valerie and my youngest son Hunter Biden. Stand up, guys. I'm proud of you. And I wish our mom, Catherine Eugenia Finnegan Biden, were here today. She'd be so damn proud, you know. Louth held such a special place in her heart, and it really did. And today, we carry her home in our heart, for real. We think about her all the time. And coming here feels like coming home, and it really does. The way, every time I've come, the welcome, the people on the streets, they're just so, so gracious to us.
President Joe Biden and the Irish Foreign Minister and former Prime Minister Michael Martin at a pub in Dundalk, Ireland. President Biden will be speaking to the Irish Parliament in Dublin on Thursday. Our coverage begins at 10:45 a.m. Eastern. Back in the United States, Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, launching a presidential exploratory committee. Political writes, it's the clearest sign yet of his intentions to run for the GOP ticket in 2024. Senator Tim Scott is the only Black Republican in the U.S. Senate. And in a video that he posted, he notes that today, in 1861, was the start of the Civil War at Fort Sumter in South Carolina. Here's a portion of his video.
Joe Biden and the radical left have chosen a culture of grievance over greatness. They're promoting victimhood instead of personal responsibility, and they're indoctrinating our children to believe we live in an evil country. And all too often, when they get called out for their failures, they weaponize race to divide us, to hold on to their power. When I fought back against their liberal agenda, they called me a prop, a token, because I disrupt their narrative. I threaten their control. They know the truth of my life disproves their lies. See, I was raised by a single mother in poverty. The spoons in our apartment were plastic, not silver. But we had faith, we put in the work, and we had an unwavering belief that we too could live the American dream. I know America is a land of opportunity, not a land of oppression. I know it because I've lived it. That's why it pains my soul to see the Biden liberals attacking every rung of the ladder that helped me climb. If the radical left gets their way, millions more families will be trapped in failing schools, crime-ridden neighborhoods, and crushing inflation. Not on my watch. This is personal to me. I will never back down in defense of the conservative values that make America exceptional. And that's why I'm announcing my exploratory committee for President of the United States. I will defend the Judeo-Christian foundation our nation is built on and protect our religious liberty. I will stand up to communist China and restore opportunities for hardworking Americans to thrive and prosper. I will fight to give every parent a choice in education so their children have a better chance in life. I will defend our borders and our neighborhood streets, and I will protect our most fundamental right, the right to life itself. I bear witness that America can do for anyone what she has done for me.
Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, a video today. Associated Press article explaining that an exploratory committee allows someone pondering a political bid to start raising money to support efforts like traveling and polling without officially becoming a candidate. It's not required, but some potential candidates do it. Also, any money raised during this time frame has to comply with federal contribution limits and be reported if a campaign is ultimately launched. And if the process doesn't lead to an official candidacy, the prospective candidate isn't required to disclose any fundraising and spending activity from the exploratory phase. That from the Associated Press. Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel saying today that Fox News will be hosting the first Republican presidential primary debate. She made the announcement this morning on the Fox News channel.
We are going to host the very first debate with Fox News. It will be a Fox News Republican primary debate.
I'm definitely watching.
You're definitely watching. You're going to have to be there, right? You're probably going. But we're also going to partner with some pretty exciting partners. For the first time ever, we're going to live stream on Rumble. We're getting away from big tech. YouTube's owned by Google. We're going to have an RNC channel on Rumble. And then the Young Americas Foundation, which is run by Scott Walker, to really reach out to young voters. They're based in Wisconsin, so they're going to be a partner.
That's RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel saying that that first presidential primary debate will be in Milwaukee, the host city for the Republicans' 2024 National Nominating Convention. During her appearance on Fox News, also asked the format of the primary debates going forward.
So let's talk about some of the problems you had last time. Not problems, but challenges. So many candidates, couldn't get them all on one stage. How do you plan on doing that? Right now you have Vivek Ramaswamy, you got Nikki Haley, you got President Trump, you have others. You saw that list.
Yeah.
How do you plan on deciding who's on stage one and stage two?
So we'll put the criteria out soon. I mean, we don't know how many candidates there are going to be, so that'll dictate if there's one or two stages. Mm-hmm. Right now I don't see there being two stages, but I could be wrong on that. It's just the field's forming later than usual.
Will you do the whole thing where the person with the most, with the highest polling gets the middle?
I'm not going to say yet. I'm going to work with our debate committee, but I think that makes sense that the person who's polling the highest should get.
When traditionally do they jump in? When in the past have you seen that?
Yeah, you know, we've seen them come in January. Right. I mean, this is late to have the field form.
I forgot about Asa Hutchinson. That's
yeah, and right. Asa's in too.
RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel this morning on the Fox News channel. The Memphis Commercial Appeal newspaper in Tennessee reporting that Shelby County commissioners reappointed Justin Pearson to the Tennessee House of Representatives Wednesday to cries of applause and cheers of excitement. The expected move from commissioners means Justin Pearson could be back in the state house as early as Thursday, less than a week after he and state lawmaker Justin Jones, who represents Davidson County, were expelled from their seats. Justin Pearson and Justin Jones, among the youngest black lawmakers in Tennessee, were expelled from the House for having led gun reform chants that briefly disrupted House proceedings 3 days after 3 9-year-olds and 3 adults were shot and killed at the Covenant School in Nashville. That reporting from the Memphis Commercial Appeal. After the reinstatement happening by the commissioners inside the county administration building, Justin Pearson went outside and spoke at a rally. He was joined by U.S. Congressman Steve Cohen, whose district includes Memphis. You'll hear from the congressman first.
Thank you, Justin, and thank you, everybody that's here. This is a great day. We've restored democracy. The New York Times today has 2 editorials facing each other. Both of them are about Tennessee and saying democracy was thwarted in Tennessee and things are changing, and there's a picture of Justin on each page of the New York Times editorial. Today is Justin's day. Today is District 86 day. Today is the day for the coveted children, the 6 3 children and 3 adults who were killed. I've got an F pin on here. That F stands for my grade from the NRA. May you get another F.
The Shelby County Commission done their job.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we get to get back to doing our job.
Yeah.
And what is our job? It's to elevate the voices of the six people in Nashville.
Yeah.
The 3 children who are just 9 years old.
Yeah.
To elevate the 5 folk in Louisville who died from gun violence that was preventable.
Yeah.
We know it's preventable because there are good laws that exist. somebody said to put a tank in front of every school. Because we go to banks.
Yeah.
We go to businesses.
Yeah.
We walk the streets.
Yeah.
We go to church.
Yeah.
These false solutions that they are advocating will not help or save anybody.
Yeah.
But a movement is rising.
Yeah.
A movement is rising.
Yeah.
See, they tried to kill democracy.
Yeah.
They tried to expel the people's choice and the people's vote.
Yeah.
And they awaken a sleeping giant.
Justin Pearson today in Memphis, Tennessee, outside the county administration building after the Shelby County Commission reappointed him to his state house seat just a few days after a vote in the General Assembly to expel him. Also there, U.S. Congressman Steve Cohen, both Justin Pearson and Congressman Cohen are Democrats. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. A story in the Wall Street Journal, a global coalition of democratic countries that champions press freedom has condemned Russia's arrest of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich and called on Moscow to immediately release him from custody. The executive arm of the Media Freedom Coalition, a partnership of 51 countries from six continents, said in a statement released Wednesday that Russia is using its authority to intimidate and harass journalists for their critical reporting in the country. Evan Gershkovich was detained 2 weeks ago and has been charged with espionage. Today, the chief news editor for the journal, Elena Cherney, taking part in a panel discussion held at Columbia Journalism School in New York City titled Free Evan. She was asked what efforts are being made by the journal and by the U.S. government to free Evan Gershkovich. You're going to hear her refer to the Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, or SPIHA, Roger Karstens.
Now that this has moved to SPIHA, to, you know, Karstens, this takes on a different, that's a very good thing. The wrongful detention designation was a very important step. It's very clear. I mean, you know, we've reported Biden called the family yesterday. This is front and center, as is the Whalen case. That process, I think, now becomes the focus, right? And I think Karstens made comments this morning about negotiations, sort of mapping out negotiations in the coming days. So that's encouraging. I think it's encouraging, but we have to be realistic about what that means. To some of David's points, what we are doing is trying to ensure that we do reach Evan with these messages, that we do what we can to keep his spirits up as well. His lawyers have been to see him apparently three times. We heard today in a you know, town hall, and there's a lot of communication. We're trying to, you know, with our own teams, but the company is trying to ensure communication and sharing of information. You know, we heard that about the visits by his lawyers. We heard that, you know, he does seem to be, under the circumstances, in good spirits, in good health. And he got a couple of updates about Arsenal, which I think was a highlight. His friends will know. So those are the kinds of things, obviously, contact with the family. But just this, it is important, we understand, to keep up a campaign. We can't let this fade from view. We need to make sure that Evan and his wrongful detention and the effort to get him back remain in the public consciousness and don't fade with the news cycle. And that's really, really important. That's why we're doing the things that we're doing. That's why we're wearing the T-shirts and doing the rest of it.
Elena Cherney is chief news editor for The Wall Street Journal. Today at the Columbia Journalism School in New York City, a panel discussion that also included reporters from The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Financial Times, and the head of Europe and Central Asia program at the Committee to Protect Journalists. You'll be able to find this full discussion archived at our website at cspan.org. This week, the U.S. State Department designating Evan Gershkovich as wrongfully detained, which the Wall Street Journal writes broadens U.S. efforts to exert pressure on Russia to free him. His case now shifts to a unit of the State Department that is focused on negotiation for the release of hostages and other Americans classified as wrongfully detained in foreign countries. Associated Press, Dateline Kyiv. Ukraine launched an investigation Wednesday into a gruesome video that reportedly shows the beheading of a Ukrainian soldier in the latest accusation of atrocities said to have been committed by Russia since it invaded in February 2022. The video spread quickly online and drew outrage from officials in Kyiv, including President Volodymyr Zelensky, as well as international organizations. The Kremlin called the footage horrible, but said it needed to be verified. President Zelensky talking about this in a virtual address to the International Monetary Fund World Bank spring meetings in Washington, D.C.
Ukraine is currently living through a storm of emotions. Yesterday, a video of the brutal murder of our soldier by the occupiers was shared by Russian sources. They are there in this video, are proud with their ability to kill. You have probably all seen it on the news, and you know that Russian army tries to make this level of violence and atrocities a routine everywhere on Ukrainian soil. Every time when they do something like this, one gets shocked, like for the first time, and death brought by Russia must not become a usual routine. The long story of Russian impunity must finally stop. And I thank everyone in the world and all of you who help Ukraine to survive. But every day we'll lose our people, men and women, adults and children who die at the hands of Russia.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking virtually to the IMF World Bank spring meetings being held in Washington, D.C. France 24 news site reports the World Bank on Wednesday said it would finance $200 million to help fix Ukraine's energy and heating infrastructure, with partners and others provide another $300 million in additional funding as the project expands. More from President Zelensky on the aid his country needs to rebuild from the war.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ukraine makes two appeals to you. The first one, priority needs for reconstruction. And I thank you. Thank you for the new program with the IMF, which is an important stabilizing factor for Ukraine. This will help us continue to fight. But in order for people to return to Ukraine, for the aggressor to lose not only on the battlefield, but truly in everything, we need the approval of the support program to cover the priority projects of fast recovery. The total volume of such projects is $14.1 billion. Our government officials who are now in Washington will present the details. And ladies and gentlemen, the second one, it's necessary to work on concrete mechanism for using frozen Russian assets to compensate for the damage caused by Russia. It must be clearly stated that the assets, including the assets of the Russian Central Bank, will be confiscated. It will be a peacemaking act on a global scale. Potential aggressors must see this and remember that the world can be stronger. There may be different formats of solutions, but the faster and more effective the solutions are, the more reliable and long-lasting peace after this war will be.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine speaking online to the IMF World Bank meetings in Washington, D.C. Attending in person in Washington, the Ukrainian Prime Minister, the World Bank President, the IMF Managing Director, and the U.S. Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen.
The United States is proud to have provided significant budget support since Russia's invasion. We have current plans to provide additional aid through September, all as grants, as well as to provide support for energy security and early recovery. I thank the World Bank for safeguarding and facilitating disbursements, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development for being an implementation partner. Supporting Ukraine is a collective effort. We welcome the efforts by our allies and partners to provide significant, predictable, and timely assistance, and urge all of us to continue doing so. The World Bank's update to its rapid damage and needs assessment underscores Ukraine's needs. Just as military assistance provides for the front lines, our economic assistance bolsters the home front. It keeps the government and economy running so Ukraine can continue to defend itself. The new IMF program will anchor our support in a sound macroeconomic framework and catalyze further reforms essential to Ukraine's recovery. Meanwhile, our historic multilateral sanctions coalition is restricting Russia's access to the technology and equipment it needs to supply its military. And with our embargoes and price caps on Russian oil and refined products, we're effectively targeting Russia's key source of revenue while maintaining stability in global oil markets. Russian state revenue from energy taxes is down over 40% since the imposition of the price cap compared to last year. We're proud to stand with Ukraine. And as President Biden has said, the United States will do what it takes to support Ukraine for as long as it takes.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen in Washington at the IMF World Bank spring meetings. Wall Street today, the Dow down 38, NASDAQ down 102, S&P down 16. Labor Department says consumer prices increased 0.1% in March versus the month before and 5% versus 1 year ago. That's the slowest pace of inflation since May 2021. The vice chair of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Travis Hill, says it was management failures, not lack of or loosely enforced regulations, that led to the failure of California's Silicon Valley Bank last month. He says there are ways to encourage banks to better manage interest rate risks and, quote, we should evaluate any potential policy changes thoughtfully. Travis Hill also pushing back against those who say the 2018 bipartisan banking reform that increased the size of a bank subject to strict oversight, $250 billion, was a cause of the failure of SVB and also Signature Bank in New York.
In Washington, D.C., a town where people tend to criticize and blame first and learn and understand later or never, there's been an effort to blame the SVB failure on S-2155, the bipartisan banking law passed in 2018. And so we have people searching under the couch cushions, under the carpets, under the mattress, in the storage closet, trying to find something somewhere to tie the SVB failure to that law and its implementing rules. I think it's quite obvious that S-2155 had nothing to do with it. The rule changes did not change the stringency of capital standards for a bank of SVB size. The stress test did not test for rapidly rising rates. And the exact thing that got SVB in trouble, investing in government bonds, is the exact thing that the liquidity coverage ratio is designed to require. The reason for SVB's failure are quite straightforward and easy to explain, and those rule changes had nothing to do with them. When it comes to something like this, I encourage people to first look at the facts and then arrive at conclusions, rather than starting with the conclusion you hope to be true and grasping around for facts and support. And I urge policymakers to propose policy changes based on where we find evident holes in our framework, rather than just trying to undo policies of the past. Financial regulators are often accused of fighting the last war. Over the past couple years, a number of banks, under the watchful eyes of supervisors, traded credit risk, the problem of the last crisis, for interest rate risk, a problem of the previous crisis. We should closely review the lessons to be learned from the recent failures and be open to targeted changes to our framework. But we should be humble about what our rules and policies can accomplish and avoid the temptation to overcorrect. In a competitive, dynamic financial services industry with thousands or millions of independent actors, there will always be vulnerabilities, and in an era of aggressive Fed tightening, there will always be bigger pressures at play. Meanwhile, the FDIC continues to do its job as it has for the past 90 years. The FDIC staff deserves tremendous credit for their efforts over the past month, with many working through the night, night after night, and through the weekends, weekend after weekend. I'll conclude with my favorite quote from one of the stories on the recent banking turmoil, when the Wall Street Journal interviewed a customer who had just confirmed his bank deposit was fully insured. He told the newspaper, quote, "If you can't trust the FDIC, it's a banana republic," end quote.
FDIC Vice Chair Travis Hill at the Bipartisan Policy Center today in Washington. Reuters reports the FDIC is set to propose next month how to make the U.S. banking sector pay for an estimated $23 billion hole in its insurance fund from the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Another Reuters article, the United States has become the first major fishing nation to ratify a deal to cut subsidies contributing to overfishing, the World Trade Organization chief said on Wednesday. The trade watchdog's 164 members reached the deal, which aims to cut billions of dollars in harmful subsidies that are emptying the ocean of marine life. But it needs two-thirds of the members to sign on to take effect, and only a handful of smaller countries have accepted it so far. The United States ratified it on Tuesday, the WTO Director General Nkosi Okonjo-Iweala wrote on Twitter. That from Reuters. The Director General spoke about it today at American University's School of International Service.
Yesterday, the United States deposited its instrument of acceptance of the Fisheries Subsidies Agreement, the first agreement on environmental sustainability ever negotiated at the WTO.
This is big. Very big.
Just a quick word, that agreement had been being negotiated to do away with $22 billion in harmful subsidies that are encouraging overfishing of our oceans and destroying ocean health. And it's been being negotiated for more than two decades. We finally got it over the finish line last June at our 12th ministerial. And now my objective is to actually get it implementation on. We need two-thirds of members to ratify. And my objective is to get it all done by next February. To have the United States come early on in the game, one of the largest fishing economies, sends a huge signal. So we accomplished that yesterday. And I'm grateful to USTR and Ambassador Tai.
World Trade Organization Director General Nkosi Okonjo-Iweala at American University in Washington, D.C. She's in Washington as well for the IMF World Bank spring meetings. The U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai, referencing the Fisheries Subsidies Agreement at a conference today on the global economy held by Semaphore News.
Does this form of trade effort reorganization in the world need the WTO anymore?
Absolutely. In fact,
you're still pro-WTO.
I don't know if you missed this news, but yesterday I submitted to Dr. Ngozi, the Director General of the WTO, our instrument of acceptance, certifying that we have signed up for the WTO Fisheries Subsidies Agreement.
Okay.
Now, we are the fourth country to do so we are early on. We wanted to set by example.
So you almost broke news here this morning. You did this yesterday.
We did this yesterday, but I'm breaking it to you now. Yes, no, go look for our statement. But you know, it is an affirmative embrace of the WTO and what it can do. This is the first WTO agreement that has as its core environmental sustainability.
U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai today at a conference in Washington, hosted by Semaphore News, looking at the global economy. More from the Reuters article on this WTO fisheries agreement. Global subsidies are estimated at $35.4 billion, according to a 2019 study published by Marine Policy. The top five subsidizers are China, the European Union, the United States, South Korea, and Japan, it said, although not all of them are considered harmful and within the scope of the WTO deal. Library of Congress announcing 25 more pieces of audio to be added to the National Recording Registry, those chosen for their cultural, historical, or aesthetic importance to the nation's recording sound heritage. Most are songs or albums, including Madonna's Like a Virgin, Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, John Denver's Take Me Home, Country Roads, and Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, also John Lennon's Imagine. Also, the first mariachi music recordings made in 1908, and the 1985 theme song to Super Mario Brothers, the first sounds from a video game to be included on the registry. and astronomer Carl Sagan's pale blue dot. The Library of Congress tweets, in 1990, Carl Sagan asked NASA to point Voyager 1 toward Earth to take a photo of our home from 3 billion plus miles away. The image inspired Sagan's book, The Pale Blue Dot, his reading of which speaks to the universe's vastness and the responsibility of human existence. Here's a few seconds of that.
It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
Astronomer Carl Sagan's 1990 recording, Pale Blue Dot, one of the 25 recordings added this year by the Library of Congress to the National Recording Registry, which was started in 2002 and now has 625 titles. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get the stories making news in Washington sent to you every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.